Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 308, featuring Bilali Mack, visual effects supervisor of Alchemy X, who is a great person to have on, and I really appreciated him talking to us. We did this a few weeks back, and he is originally from West Africa, but after experiencing some culture shock, moving to the United States as a kid, and to Connecticut more specifically, he decided to sort of explore different things. He went to Emerson College, a great school in Boston, and he discovered that making films on a computer was going to be a something that was, to him at least, easier to try to get his message across. So he really explored CG in that way, and this led to him to having a career in visual effects. More specifically, a commercial flame artist is something that he got into, which we talk about because I, worked in commercial VFX as well. And flame artists in that area are very, very special. And I thought it was a really cool conversation to talk about flame and what that means as well. He's now gone beyond that. He's now done a lot of visual effects supervising, and he's also done some his own directing and then some other great projects. So it's really great to see what he's up to. And actually, I kind of missed working visual effects in commercials a little bit because people like Bilali were always a lot of fun to work with and think on your feet and do those types of things. So really cool having him on. So thank you so much for doing that, and a great way to kick off 2021. All right, a couple of announcements. We have for all of our events, you can go to chaosgroup.com/events. And on January 12th of 2021 of this year, we have a free webinar for V-Ray 5 for Rhino. So go check that out. That is January 12th, 2021. And for all other events, just go to chaosgroup.com/events and get all your information there. In other news, which you can find just on our homepage at chaosgroup.com, let you guys know that Vantage is out. And we have already announced this before, but Vantage is our fully ray-traced, full real-time package that allows you to bring in your VR scenes and make them view them in real time. So it's really, really cool. Currently free, so you should check it out. You can go to, if you want to be able to experience this, or even we decided to celebrate this by kicking off a competition, and you can find out more about this. We partnered with our friends at Lenovo and NVIDIA and CG Architect and Kitbash 3D, and we created this competition called Building Utopia, and you can find out all this information by going to buildingutopia.cgarchitect.com. Again, that's buildingutopia.cgarchitect.com. So really excited to see that. All right. And if you guys happen to have gotten some new hardware for the holidays, you want to test out how fast it is, don't forget the new V-Ray benchmark is out, and that is based on V-Ray 5. So you can check that out as well at chaosgroup.com. All right. If people are interested in finding out more about the podcast, you can go to facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast, or you can go to chaosgroup.com/CG Garage. And if you have any ideas about the podcast, we of course welcome them, or any comments, labs@chaosgroup.com. And don't forget to give us a rating and a review about the podcast, if you'd like to, on Apple Podcast, and share us with all your friends. Unfortunately, Kristen could not join me for this particular podcast intro, but don't worry, she will be back. She's on vacation right now, so I am just giving her a break. You can also go to our YouTube, which is Chaos Group TV, and all of our podcasts are live there, as well as the fact that you can look at these podcasts in video format on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast. All right, that being said, please enjoy this awesome podcast with Bilali Mack.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Well, cool. I like your black and white video. This is cool. Is this a look you do? Do you do videos normally, or is this
something? Yeah, I do a lot of, we do a lot of Zoom calls and meetings, and I just find that when I'm on them, like, there's always like something in the background that has like a weird color that is like distracting, and I'm just like, you know what, I just go black and white. I feel like it's easier that way for me.
Okay. Well, that's cool. That's great. That's really good. So I hear you have an interesting backstory about how you ended up doing the kind of things you do. Would love to know sort of your origin stories and how you got started and got into visual effects you know, all of that stuff. So why don't you give us a little bit of your origin story, if that's cool.
Yeah. So, I mean, my name is Bilali Mack. And right now I'm a visual effects supervisor at Alchemy X. I was born and raised in West Africa. And moved to the States, in like 1999. Moved to the States in 1999.
Yeah. So about what age were you at this point?
I was about nine.
Nine. Okay.
Eight or 9 years old. Yeah. So we moved to the States when I was about nine, moved to Windsor, Connecticut, lived there. Yeah. So going from West Africa to Windsor, Connecticut is kind of a big jump culturally.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I was born in Cairo, believe it or not. So,
Oh really? Oh wow.
I was an American, but I was born in Cairo. And so I can understand a cultural jump, especially, you know, at 9 years old, it must have been, you know, you had enough history behind you to understand that difference.
Oh and, yeah, for sure. And when we came in the winter and I hadn't seen snow before.
Right.
You know, so that's always like you see snow growing up in Africa, like in films and TV shows and stuff like that.
Yep.
But then when you actually see it for the first time and touch it, it kind of felt like magic, you know? But so moved to Windsor, Connecticut, where I was kind of basically born, like I was basically raised in Connecticut.
Yeah.
And then I went to school in Boston, and I went to Emerson College
for
computer animation.
Yeah.
After that, moved.
So what motivated you to do computer animation? What was your drive there?
Yeah. I mean, I honestly got into computer animation program by accident. I was supposed to be a film major, and they had a fantastic film production program. So I applied for film, but something got messed up in application process. And I ended up being placed in the computer animation program, which was relatively new at the time.
Okay.
And so I basically was like too lazy to fill out the application to switch to the film program. They told me that, yeah, you're classified as computer animation, but because you're in the visual media arts department, you can still take film classes. So for the first couple of years, I just took the film classes that I was allowed to take as a visual media arts major. And I was like, junior year, I'll switch it so that on my degree, it says film program. But I ended up like falling in love with computer animation. Like by the sophomore year, we started getting into like my computer animation class with Maya. And I started getting into Maya and I started getting into After Effects, motion graphics and things like that. And I just felt that like it was so much easier to tell stories and create films inside a computer than talking to like my other colleagues in school that were like dragging these giant cameras and dragging these giant, you know, because I really just wanted to tell stories. And I was able to do a thesis where I could use a computer and create a film essentially without having to. I really liked the idea that I didn't have to like rent out equipment. I didn't have to depend on a bunch of people if I didn't need to. Obviously, if you're doing more complicated CGI animation or a CG film, like you need other people in other departments. But I was also young and I was naive.
You can do a lot by yourself. You know, that's
but
thing,
yeah, you can. You totally can. And that was what it felt very empowering to me. I was like, man, I can make a lot of this by myself in a room and not having to worry about it. And I kind of just at that time I was like, it would be much easier not having to deal with trying to work with other people and negotiate on like renting equipment and finding locations, et cetera, et cetera. Cause I had taken a couple of those film program courses and I realized how much harder it is to actually make a live action film.
Right.
Not saying creating CG films are easy, but you know, like dealing with the real world.
Sure.
And so I stuck with it for two years and kind of like fell in love. And I was like, okay, I guess this is an accident that's meant to be. And I didn't end up switching my major, and I stuck with it. After I finished graduating with my thesis, I interned at a place in Boston called Brickyard VFX.
Oh, yeah.
And I worked with Dave Waller and Anders Beer. Mm-hmm. And I worked there for basically like 6 months, and it was commercials.
Yeah.
I worked in the CG department, but there was also Flame, which was like visual effects, compositing, commercial software. Mm-hmm. And I worked with those guys for 6 months and then got a job opportunity in New York City at Smoke and Mirrors, which was a commercial visual effects house in the city, in Soho. Worked there for another 3 years, started out in the machine room, essentially. From the machine room, moved on to the, ended up moving on to Flame, actually.
Really?
And I was really hellbent on being a CG artist, but there weren't many opportunities. Like, we had a stacked CG department, and there were 6 Flames at the time and 2 Flame artists. And Flames at the time were really sought after, really expensive pieces of equipment and software. And so I was just like,
I've got one in my bedroom right now, believe it or not, because my wife's
really?
My wife's a Flame artist, and since we have to work from home, they let her take one home.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yep.
Work from home, baby. That's it.
Bring the Flame with you.
Bring the Flame, Flame on the go.
Yeah.
I jumped in one of those seats, just started helping out with roto and you know, and paint work, and gradually moved up to like junior Flame artist. And after that, got promoted to full on Flame artist after 3 years. And then I applied to a job, a couple places. I applied to the Mill, and then I applied to MPC in the city. I got an offer from both, but I decided to go with MPC.
Yeah.
It was smaller, and I felt like it was a good fit for me at the time. It also helped they were offering me more money. So
now, was this still for commercial work that you were doing?
It was still commercial work.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Still in commercials.
Yep.
Moved to MPC. I worked there for 3 years, worked on a bunch of commercials, like, you know, Coca-Cola, like, and BMW, worked on some commercials for like Lance Accord. We did some stuff with Russo Brothers near the end for Cadillac, Oscars, and stuff like that. And then, after a while, I had at that time been like 7 years working in commercials almost. And I was kind of like, man, I feel like I want to try something new. And episodics were getting really hot, you know, with Netflix and Amazon Prime. And I was like, okay, let me give a shot at episodics. And I was looking around town and saw that there was a visual effects supervisor position at Alchemy X. Mm-hmm. And I had been doing a lot of on-set supervision and supervising and leading at MPC. So I applied for the position, met the team, met everybody there. And I got the job. And and so I started out at Alchemy as a visual effects supervisor in I would say January of last year. And so worked there, and the first show that I probably worked on was a film that just came out called Let Him Go with Kevin Costner.
Okay.
And we did some smoke visual effects because there's a house that catches on fire. So we did a bunch of scenes, a couple sequences where we had smoke filling up the house and fire, and amping that up so that it felt like there was really danger of the fire in that sequence. And then I was also the visual effects supervisor for like one of our main kind of like tentpole shows, which is it's called Ghost, but it was called Power originally. It's a Starz TV show. Mm-hmm. It's known as like the 50 Cent show on Starz. Yeah. It's like their number one like show right now for Starz. It's the one that kind of like brings in all their fans and stuff like that.
Awesome.
So that's kind of my story, and that's kind of how I got into visual effects supervision at the moment now. And that's kind of how it happened.
So are you still, you still consider yourself a flame artist as well? Do you still get on the box and stuff? Because I know a lot of flame artists, they still tend to like want to get their hands dirty. You know?
Yeah, it's funny that you say that, because I feel like it's a different kind of route coming into visual effects as like a flame artist, because you're right. Yeah, I do have that itch to always kind of like be on the box and running the show. I'm sure, right, as your wife knows, it's like she probably does a tons of like supervised sessions with clients and things like that. And so, yeah, I do. I jump in the box every once in a while, and I love getting into flame and just mocking stuff up. I use it for look dev. It's really fast. It's great for looking at things in context, you know? Mm-hmm. So if I have like a sequence, I love to try to see if I can pull it into flame, take a look at it. I get my hands dirty, and I also have projects that I work on. Like I've got like a short film, and I work on music video projects with other clients that I know. And I do a lot of collaborating with other artists. And so I'll end up using flame. I jump between flame and nude, but obviously because I grew up as a flame artist in my career. That's like my first thing that I jump to. And
interesting,
if something like the particle system, or you know, like I'm trying to do some CG compositing or something, I'll definitely jump into Nuke to try to do those things, you know, because the 3 environment still is not as good in Flame as it is in Nuke, and as well as CG compositing at the moment, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, the painting tools.
Tools in Flame are unbelievable. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're still some of the best, you know, and
there's
that's
a reason it's still around.
Yeah, exactly.
My wife learned to use a flame. The first flame she used a long time ago, it was an SGI purple monster refrigerator size thing that cost $1 million. Right. And that's what a flame was. But so that's how long the system has been around.
It's been around for a long time.
Yeah. So the thing that's important is that like it can paint really, really, really well, and it can track
really
stuff.
Well.
Yeah.
And really fast. The tracking is fantastic. It's really fast. And you know, like you cache everything, you can see it, the playback, you can see like frame per frame playback, you know? And so that's why I use it a lot of times when I'm trying to do like quick iterative things that I just want to be able to see quickly, you know. It's super fast, super steppy. And that's what I love about flame, is that it feels like, I say this a lot, but like I want to feel as if I'm not on a machine, you know. I want to feel like I'm moving and my reflexes are doing the work, and I'm kind of like painting, or you know, you want to feel like it's second nature. And when you have things like lag, or you have to wait for things to like frame buffer, that kind of breaks my concentration. You want to get into that like zen state where you're just like flowing. I think they call it flow state. And that's what I love about flame, is that I've always felt like I can, that's like the closest I've been able to get as far as like a visual effects artist on a software. And I'm sure Nuke can get you there, you know. It's just, I think flame, part of the combination of the hardware requirements, you know, like you can't just put it on anything. You make sure you have to have a certain amount of RAM software. Yep. The architecture of the software as well. It's just built for that. And that's what flame artists are known for, I think, especially in the commercial space, is like people that are flame artists do a lot of in-person client work, and you don't want a crazy advertising creative behind you. And they're like, can you do this thing? And you're like, wait, hold on. We're going to wait like 10 minutes for this to render. And then, you know, it needs to feel fast, smooth, and
Yeah.
And that's the whole deal.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the really tough. I mean, it's interesting. There's a lot of things I want to discuss with you here.
Yeah,
specifically,
sure.
You know, like, you know, you started off doing, you know, more quote unquote traditional CG, where you're doing some Maya and After Effects and things of that nature. Right. So that's great. So you actually had some 3D training and things of that nature.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So
super helpful.
Yeah. Right. So it gives you context also, because as a flame artist, you need to, you know, you may, while you may not be necessarily making some of the 3D assets, at least you know what's coming in and have an idea of what that is, you know?
Yeah.
So that's very interesting as well. But what's interesting, you know, like you said, like the flame is not just a piece of hardware and a system. it's the whole, especially in the commercial, because I worked at I did commercials for a long time as well, and you have a flame suite, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And it is a room specifically for the artist to sit and have all these monitors, and there's clients behind you that are overseeing everything you're doing.
Yes.
It's very stressful.
It's very stressful.
Right. And they are sitting there paying a lot of money, up to $1,000 an hour, to sit in that suite and see you fix pixels. Mm-hmm. And they can see
in
real time. So it is a very stressful job. And I know this both not only just from my wife, but also working in commercials, because I was also the VFX supervisor, not the flame artist, that would be there sort of massaging between the flame artist and that. Oh, it is a political hot potato to deal with that.
I miss it every day.
Yeah. But what's also interesting is how much stuff can get fixed on a flame that, especially a lot of 3D artists, and I want to stress this, a lot of 3D artists, who is a lot of my audience, think a flame is just a compositing package that can do that.
Yeah.
But you can fix things on a flame that I was shocked. I'll just give you an example. I was doing a car commercial, and the director did not like the reflection on the car. Right? Wanted it to move to the other side. And I was like, I could try to go up there and re-render that shot, and it'll move the, it's a simple thing. It's really just move the light. But the problem is you have to re-render everything. So you have to wait for it on the farm. Exactly. Right. So, and the flame artist said, you go ahead and do that. I'll see what I can do here. And we'll, you know, on the flame. And by the time I came back down, he had already fixed it on the flame. He had moved the entire reflection on the, I don't know how he did it,
but
he did it.
I knew.
Yeah. And it was like, that'll do. Yeah. That's perfect.
Yeah.
And so,
I was just going to say that's part of the magic of flame, is that the reason that flame artists do those things and try those things is not always that flame has like special magical tools that no other software, because software is software. But part of the position you're put in as a flame artist, especially in commercial advertising industry, is you're the very last stop before the commercial actually goes out to air. So more often than not, you end up being the person that fixes everything from editorial issues to CG issues to sound. Sometimes I've had to do some sound stuff, which is like blasphemy as a flame artist. You should never, ever do that, but I've done it, you know?
Yeah.
So we end up being put in positions where we're fixing reflections on cars. We're getting rid of people. We're manipulating people's faces. Like, you get asked to do so many things. And what happens inevitably is that you have to flex your creative muscle as an artist, and you have to try to be as creative as possible with 2D compositing. And there is 3D compositing, but there are so many tricky things that people can do in flame that they only are able to do because there is so much pressure on you to just get it done.
Right.
And it's not that there's some kind of magic. It's just that the commercial has to air in 5 hours. If it doesn't, they're going to lose $1 million, right, in airtime. So you have 5 hours to try to save this commercial that has to go out before they lose $1 million. I guarantee you there is a way. You will figure out, you will paint it into submission if you have to. Right. I've seen I worked with a flame artist, like incredible flame artist, more old school. And when you think, if you look at the things that these old school 2D flame artists were doing back in like the 90s, that we would say, there's no way, you need an effects sim. You need that to be rendered through Houdini. You would be blown away. I have seen people like morph, and this all comes from like the painting and the warping, and a lot of artists now don't have that experience of like manually painting and warping and being able to like submit images to your will in that way. I knew an artist that would do almost everything in paint, and that's how you know someone's like really, really old school. He would paint one layer of paint And then he would render that out and then pull that back in, paint on top of it, render it back out, paint on top of it until he got what he wanted. He could paint, in ways that there are probably very few artists that can now. He could turn a car into a butterfly all in paint by warping and pushing and then bringing that into another module and then warp it and push it. And before you know it, he got like a butterfly to fit into a cup and it looks seamless. Right. Now, if you ask him to move that butterfly or change the timing, he couldn't do it again because it's so destructive.
Right, but right.
He could get it done if you need it, like you said. And that's the mentality of a flame artist. It's like, okay, I don't need to do this procedurally. I don't need to do this in a way where someone will ever touch it again. What can I do in 5 hours to push this thing across the finish line?
Right.
And that's a lot of the mentality of flame artists, that I think there are obviously positive things and negative things, but when time is of essence, sometimes that I find myself leaning on those skill sets and that mental, that mind state of just trying to figure out a quick way to get this thing out because it's delivery. And I'll be like, you know what, just send it to me. I'll fix it. It's like, there are so many CG things that people are like, we have to re-render. I'm like, give me that thing. I'll fix the texture. I'll fix the lighting. I'll fix the paint. Let's just get it out. We're not going to see it again. It's not worth it. You know?
Yeah. I knew a flame artist who did something similar. There was a commercial and it had to involve like a phoenix made out of water. Right.
Yeah.
So it was like this water phoenix, like flying. And I was like, okay, so you got to do a fluid sims. You got to do this and that. And then he says, no, I'm going to do it all on the flame. I was like, how? And I was like, I've seen some amazing things. Like, how? And he basically just took a bunch of elements of slow motion or water balloons popping and just took them all and then positioned them on the flame and made a phoenix.
Yeah.
And it was perfect. Yeah. It was
you could make it. And it's painting, right? It's like you're painting and you're using your imagination.
And he did it in a day.
Yeah. You're using your imagination. And I feel like there's a lot of artists that, you know, would benefit from thinking outside the box in that way, you know, because I think the nature of commercial advertising kind of forces you to have to do that because, we don't have 3 days to do fluid sims and re-render and rewrite. Right. And the client, you just need the client to buy off on it once. That's it. Just do something that can work for that moment. Obviously, if you have like a pipeline, and that's what I've gotten more used to with episodic pipeline, is that, other people need to jump in and touch things and do things. So I can't just be like, I'm going to do this in a one-off way when we have 6 episodes that are going to need that same fluid phoenix in it. You know, so there's no way I could just do that and be like, I did it this way. And you guys are just gonna have to replicate it every single time exactly the same.
Right. Yeah. And that is actually that's interesting you brought that up, because I've known some flame artists and they're put in the position of VFX supervisor and they can't seem to tear themselves away from the box, as opposed to actually sitting there and supervising and giving guidance and giving feedback. They'll say, give me whatever you got and I'll fix it from here. And it's and that's kind of a dangerous position to be in.
It is dangerous. And totally, it's dangerous. And when I first started, I had kind of that mentality. I actually did it on my very first job.
Okay.
My first job working, like we were close, like that show, Let Them Go. We were close to getting to the end. And I just couldn't get it to where I wanted it to be. And so I was just like, screw it. Just give me this thing. Because you're you have to think of it this way. You're like a high performing artist as far as like pressure and getting things done. As a flame artist, you're always kind of in that mindset and mentality, and failing is like not an option. So when you see somebody struggling with something that like feels really close and you're like, well, I was like in the NBA of getting shit done really quick. Oh, sorry. I don't know if I swear on this.
You can.
Oh,
okay. It's fine.
Oh, okay. I was like in the NBA of getting stuff done.
Right.
Really quickly and efficiently. Just give me this thing. I already see how I could do this in 10 minutes. And you just can't, you're right. You can't pull yourself away, but it's dangerous for especially film and episodic, like the system that you're building. You want it to be a machine that's like well oiled and runs and can keep running without you there. You shouldn't have to jump in to, you know, get the thing across like the last 20% every single time. you need to be the visual effects supervisor. That is a different role. And yeah, it took a little bit of time. Like after I did that a couple times and I was just like, I really shouldn't be doing that. Like I should make sure that they can just get this thing done. And actually what I realized is I was like, actually you're being a bad visual effects supervisor by doing that, because you're lazy. You're not trusting your artists. You're not pushing them to get you the result that you need for the project.
Yep.
I feel good. It's actually selfishness. I feel good. Cause I'm like, as a flame artist, you're always like, I'm coming to save the day, baby. I'm swooping in to save it. Like you said,
yeah.
Every flame artist, you said you're going to take whatever amount of time to go do it. I have a client right behind me. I'm like, yeah, go do that. While the client's here, I'll save the day and look like the hero. Right. And so that's like kind of the mentality. You have to pull yourself away. You're like, there is no client here that you're like really trying to be the hero and save the day. Right. Saving the day would get your art. It would be like getting your artist to make the thing and do it right and get it done.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. But it's interesting because when you're an artist, a flame artist, your main communication is with the client, right?
Yeah.
Face to face, right? When that's a kind of an interesting role and a very good role to have as a VFX supervisor, because you actually have to communicate to both the artist and the client still, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's kind of cool because you've already learned that skill. You know how to communicate.
Yes.
You know how to do those things. But talking to a group of artists, how is that skill to learn? Like actually talking to them and understanding and having that patience, like
I mean, the good thing going from a place like Smoke and Mirrors to a place like MPC was that MPC, they still had that old school like flame artist in the room getting it done, but we had the infrastructure of MPC. So we would work with flame, and as a flame artist at MPC, you decided which shots were better suited to be done in flame. And which shots that you're like, okay, we've got a lot more nuke artists. My time is better spent managing the project, managing the team. What should I be giving out to the nuke artists to get done? What makes more sense given the resources we have? And so I got a lot of experience working with like our matte painters, working with our like nuke compositors, effects, you know? And so I was able to transition pretty easily. Not as many nuke artists as we had as we have now at Alchemy, but the scale is different and I had to get used to that. But I'd worked with on big commercial project teams of like 10, 12 other artists, you know, underneath me, like a DMP artist, possibly an effects artist, and having like, you know, 8 or 9 nuke compositors on a big commercial. Like a 60-second commercial, you have like, I don't know, 30 shots or something like that, 15, 30 shots. Mm-hmm. If it's like a car commercial, you could have double that, something that's like really fast cutting, you know? And so I did get that experience. One thing that I did have to get used to moving from commercials to episodic was just like the pipeline, you know, a little bit of the jargon as far as like managing a project in an episodic pipeline, and also doing on-set supervision commercials versus episodic was very different.
Can you explain some of that, like those differences and how those were?
Yeah. So for me, a lot of the times in commercials, one of the big things was in commercials as a visual effects or a flame artist, depending on how much time there is for the project, you could be thrown in anywhere from when they have storyboards to after they've shot the thing, you know? And so there were a lot of times where if they planned accordingly, I would jump in as a visual effects supervisor, and I would help them look at their storyboards. I would help them look at their script, and 60-second scripts are like, I don't know, 6 pages maybe. Or a little longer. But I would look at those things and we would come up with solutions. Usually the agency would come to us and be like, hey, we are thinking of doing this thing. We have these boards. Can you guys help us figure out how to do this? Because it would be contingent on some bigger visual effects thing or some kind of solution that they needed, like snow or rain, things that were more applicable to commercials.
Right.
And so those are a few times we were involved early. But once that happened, there was a quick turnaround from looking at the script to going on set. And I never really got a lot of time with the production. Most of the time, I would just, the production had already decided on a lot of the things. The director had decided on how, maybe if you're lucky, you got like one or two calls with the director. And he'd be like, I'm thinking about doing this way. Is that going to work? Can you come? And I'd be like, yeah, I don't know if that will work for us. And he'd be like, well, this is how we're doing it. Can you come just watch it and make sure this? And I'd be like, okay, I like, can you at least shoot like a clean plate? And can we like maybe lock off the camera? And they'd be like, okay, yeah, we can do that. And then I fly down to go supervise for those kind of concessions that production were going to make, because the turnaround time for commercials, like they have maybe 2-3 shooting days for like a normal commercial. If you're lucky, it's like a big one. You might get like a big commercial, will probably have like a week of shooting, you know,
that's a huge commercial.
That's a huge commercial. That's
most
like
of them are like
second.
A day or two. Like, yeah. Yeah,
yes, exactly. Yeah. And most of the commercials I had were 2 days, you know, two days of shooting. If you had like a huge commercial, it'd be like 4 days, maybe 4 or 5 days.
Right.
And so that was part of the thing. I just never felt as a visual effects supervisor as involved in the process. And I didn't feel like they were bringing me on early enough.
You weren't part of the team. You were sort of an afterthought. Right?
Exactly. Visual effects is sort of like more of an afterthought. You're brought in to fix things or mitigate disasters. You know,
right.
They're just like, the agency isn't very familiar with visual effects. And they're just like, we want to bring the visual effects guy there just to watch this thing and make sure that this thing doesn't happen in a terrible way, so that you have, they're covered visual effects wise when we're going back to put this thing together.
Right.
So transitioning from that to episodic, where I was being brought in the very beginning, like before they even shot things or came up with things, I was talking to the executive producers. I was talking to line producers. I was talking to the director and the assistant director about how we were going to do things, how we were going to execute things. It was just so much more planning and preparation. And if you told them, I don't know if we can do this thing this way, they'd be like, okay, cool. Like, is there a better way that we could do this? And I was just like, you actually asking for my opinion on this right now? I was just throwing it back, you know? I was just like, okay, well, maybe let's try this, and that. And like, okay, yeah, we can try that. We can try it. Maybe we should do some tests. And I was like, what? You guys are going to do tests on these things before we shoot? Yeah, we're going to shoot some tests. We can send you a little video or whatever and see what you think about it. I just felt so much more involved. I feel so much more part of the production, you know, because the production runs everything. There isn't like an agency that is working with the production. It's like there is just the production. So it felt like there was so much less politics.
Yep.
I just had to, you know, manage that relationship with the client, which is the production. And I'm usually talking with the director and I'm usually talking with the AD very early on, and we're figuring out solutions and
working on schedules for shooting.
Yeah. And I just was like so blown away. I was like, man, this is crazy. Like, these guys actually like listen to me. They prepare in advance. They, you know, I'm like warning them about things, and then they'll be like, okay, you come on set for these days and make sure you double tell us not to do that thing. I'm like, okay, yeah. And they were so happy to have me come involved in the process earlier and try to help them with the whole thing. And it just felt like such a great working relationship. It felt much more collaborative. Not to say that I had a couple agency clients and agency people that had bought in, but you have to work so much harder to get agency clients to buy into that collaborative relationship. And once I did, I have a couple commercial clients that like I love working with, because they're like, yeah, let's call Bilali about this thing way before we start putting this together or bidding, blah, blah, blah. And those are fantastic. But more often than not, I was being brought in to fix things, you know, and that's not a good way to approach visual effects, because you can only fix a thing so much depending on how fucked up it is. You know, it's like,
and
that was what frustrated me the most, you know, with episodic stuff. I was like, okay, they want to do this thing. Let's talk through this together before we lock ourselves into it. Maybe there's a better way I can help you to approach this shot, approach this car crash, you know, some way of saving you more money. And at the end of the day, I think like as a visual effects supervisor, you're indebted to the script, you know, and the story. And I just didn't feel like I had that opportunity to do right by the script and the story always, you know, like I felt like when you're thinking of things as afterthoughts, the story might be sacrificed because of, you know, not having there enough time. So I have to take a shortcut, and I don't want to take shortcuts on stuff because I want it to look good. You know, you want to have pride in the work you're doing. And I feel like a lot more with episodic, like it feels like I'm collaborating with true storytellers, you know, people that want to do right by the script. They want the story to be as good as possible. Yeah,
for sure. For sure. I think, you know, what's interesting to me, and what I found, especially when I was doing commercials and I was souping commercials, one of my favorite times was actually the bidding process. If you were, like you said, if you're lucky enough to be, to do the bidding, right?
To bid
before
not like
shot.
A post, not, yeah, but bid before a shot, exactly. You don't want to be bidding after they shot everything.
No, the worst. There was a head of a studio that she would basically hand me a bid saying, I bid this for you here, do it for this much money. I'm like, what?
Yeah, that's how it works in commercials. It's like, this is
sometimes
how it is.
But that's wrong, and it was completely wrong, and basically that was the way that people, she would do that so that she would win the bid, and she just didn't care. It's like, well, you figure it out. Like, thanks, you know.
It gets thrown down to the artist.
I know. And it's like, thanks. So, but what I liked is when they would come up to you, you know, let's say, is they would say, we have this crazy commercial idea, and here's the storyboards, and we need it done for like 25 cents, right? And I was like, okay, well.
That's fun.
I know, right?
But that's more fun. That's more fun because it's like, okay, before you shot it, we're coming up together and we're like, we understand the limitations. We understand that we're going into, it reminds me of film school when you're doing like a exercise. It's like you have a ball, a cat, and a man walking down the street. Tell a story, you know? Mm-hmm. You're like, you have this amount of time, you have this amount of money, and this is the idea. How can we make it work and get the punch through, you know? Right. And like you were saying, like for me, when you think of things like that, then you really can put on your hat as a storyteller, as a visual effects artist, and you can be like, what is the most important part of this story? Where can we focus most of our resources to get the maximum impact for the story? And I think that's like what separates good visual effects supervisors, that you have your limitations and you have a good understanding of the audience. You have a great understanding of the story and what the goal of that scene or sequence is or commercial. And you're like, okay, where am I going to put my emphasis as far as a visual effects artist? Is it invisible visual effects that I'm doing? Is it a, you know, is it like a gag thing that I'm trying to pull off to make people laugh? You know, because as a visual effects artist, I think you get to a next level when you start realizing that there should be some kind of character in the work that you're doing. You know, it should have some, the visual effects aren't just visual effects. They need to serve a purpose and have a meaning. And I usually try to push my artists to be like, when they do something, I like, give me like a reason, you know, like consciously, why did you make some of these choices? And these are the same reasons. These are the same things that you tell normal artists. And I think that's why I call artists artists. You know, I remember when I was a flame artist, people would call flame artists. The English term was flame operator. And I never really liked that because I was like, it means what? Like, I'm just sitting here pushing buttons. I don't have a say. Like, you can find anyone that's an operator, but a flame artist is someone that has an opinion. They have a perspective on the work that they're doing, you know, just like a visual effects artist has an opinion and perspective on the work that they're doing.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, you know, it's interesting because it comes back to you going to film school. you know, when you, or when you were, you know, in college, when you're thinking about like, I just want to tell stories, right? So it seems exactly. like to you, you wanted to, you always wanted to tell a story. Now it's a little more subtle the way you tell a story or contribute to the story in visual effects, but there is some contribution that's being done there that's beyond just doing that. So how do you feel that you're able to continue to tell stories in some of the work you're doing?
Yeah, I think for sure there is, I think the collaboration between the production and myself as a visual effects artist in the beginning helps a lot with that. But a lot of the ways that right now for shows I'm telling stories, I'll give you an example of the first film that I kind of like worked on. There was a lot of smoke that needed to fill the house, but while there was a giant fire happening, But I approached this in the language of story with the concept of the smoke in the home, right? They just came to me and said, okay, the house is on fire. We need smoke. A lot of smoke needs to be going through the house. And I was like, okay, like, but what's happening in the scene? And they were like, what? Like, why do you need to know what's happening in the scene? We just need more smoke because there's a fire happening. Right. And I was like, okay, I can see that some of these sections have more fire, but like I need to know the story so I know how to like direct the smoke. And they thought I was like crazy because I was like, I need to direct the smoke. They're like, okay, visual effects guy, go direct your smoke. Have fun.
Yep.
Yeah. And I ended up being able to have conversations with the director, and it was like the fire is building up in the beginning all the way to the end where the house completely gets engulfed in flames and collapses. Right.
Right.
So my idea was that the smoke would be kind of like menacing character that got bigger and moved faster throughout rooms as the fire kept growing throughout the sequence.
Sure.
And with that kind of idea creatively for the visual effects, it made it so much easier for us to have kind of a compass when we're like, do we need more smoke here? Do we need less smoke here? We're like, okay, well, we're halfway through the sequence. It should have already come down the stairwell. Let's add more here. It actually makes it so much easier because you have a compass for like where you're going creatively, visual effects wise, when you're working on a sequence. And anybody that has a good sense of story, I would argue, is probably better at getting to a great result as a visual effects artist for a visual effects sequence. And the more visual effects you have in a shot, and the more visual effects you have in a shot, the better you have to be at telling that story, because you go from having something that there's a lot of practical effects inside of a shot, or there's a lot of plate photography that you're working with, to a guy on a green screen. How do you figure out what's there? You have to craft some kind of composition. You have to create some kind of story, some kind of intent for the visual effects. That's when you really start pushing the level, I think, of a visual effects artist and how creative they can be with their scenes. And so for me, I think for sure a lot of the times I'm doing this with even things like blood, like even when someone gets shot in the chest, even times where I probably don't necessarily need to be doing it. But like for me, it's like you have to think that way or else your work is going to suffer. It's not going to have a foundation. Someone's getting shot in the chest with a 9mm gun and a revolver. The amount of blood that comes out is going to be different depending on the gun. But also for me, I'm going to change the amount of blood depending on what's happening. Is this a main character that's getting shot in the chest? And is it like a big scene where they're like a main character that's dying? Am I supposed to make the audience feel like this amount of blood coming out and the hole in his chest is going to kill the person, or is it that could they survive possibly? And that's like a story point with just shooting a bullet through a person's chest, you know? And that has a lot of impact as a visual effects artist. You have a lot of impact when you're doing a shot like that.
You also like have the ability to make that choice as opposed to doing it practically. You don't really know what you're going to do.
You're not locked in. Yeah.
Right.
You're not locked in.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where I push myself. I think a lot of visual effects artists and creatives, because I think a lot of the times visual effects artists are thought of as afterthoughts, you know, I hate the saying like fix it in post, because it's just like you're there to be like garbage person. No, you should be collaborating with visual effects in the very beginning to get the best possible product. And it sucks because visual effects artists like us are, as an industry, is so young compared to every other department in the filmmaking and storytelling process for film and TV and even commercials. You know, it's like you wish that we could be thought of as an important early collaborator to help make the story as good as possible. And I think I would argue that the films that do that also end up being better. You know, they end up being better for it. And you can tell a film that is utilizing visual effects well versus one that isn't, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think it's also a matter of efficiency too, you know? For example, go back to that bidding example. One of the things I used to love is when they say they want it for 25 cents or something like that. And then you're like, okay, we can't do what you wanted exactly for 25 cents. But what if we do this? And if you're saying we can change, like, what if we change the story a little bit and choose this instead? And
they're
like, and sometimes they're like, oh, and then you're actually like making the story with them, you know?
Yes.
And then what's even better about that, this is on the pure on the client side, is like, then you start to develop a relationship with that director before you even won the job.
Exactly.
And you know what? It's going to be hard for them to say no and go with someone else after you've already started that relationship, even if it may cost a little bit more.
No, it's true, because you surprise a director or a client on a better solution in a phone call with them. I guarantee you they are going to be thinking about you when they come out. If you, because for me as a visual effects artist and as working with clients, I always think of my job as like trying to make my client look better. You know, I want to jump off a call and they're like, damn, I didn't even think like we could do something like that. That would make it 10 times better. But it takes a lot. Like you have to have a lot of experience. I think like talking to clients and doing that over and over to the point where you realize like, okay, I can anticipate where they're trying to go with this thing. I know where they want to go with this thing. Let me offer them something. Maybe it's not exactly what they want, but it'll be better for the story and it'll be better for, you know, the end product. But that's someone that's really in tune with the client that they're talking about. And it's also someone that's really in tune with listening to the person that is they're talking to, you know?
Right.
I could tell you must be great at that. You know, that's definitely someone that can offer that a lot of experience.
Yeah. I mean, it's an important part of the relationship, right? Because, you know, if you do something and also if you do it well the first time, you get a good impression, you know, they come back, especially in commercials, right? Where those jobs are really short. So you'll do a job, you'll get it done. You know, maybe it's like a month between bidding and finished commercial. But that director is going to have another job and he or she may come back to you and is like, I want to work on another one with you. I have another idea. Yeah. This was so much fun. Right. And that's those are the times when it's great. When it's like, that was so much fun.
Yeah. And I've had a lot of jobs like that. That's the thing. It is kind of, it's commercial world is fun because you're right. If you have a great client and you have a great relationship, it becomes fun because you're like pumping out these really fun, short, awesome projects. You know, it's like working on a bunch of awesome short films. If you can get to that point, you're working together, collaborating with the director, the agency, and you guys are doing a bunch of really great short films. So that's the fun of that, because working in commercials, I just got a lot of variety. I think it's a great place to start working as a visual effects artist because you get to work on a lot of variety of types of work, you know, episodic, doing episodics right now. I'm getting a little bit of variety, but I'm so glad that I got so much. Like I could be working on like a commercial with dragons in like 1 week, and then 2 weeks later working on something with like, I don't know, a bunch of cool, sexy car commercials where we're changing the entire landscapes. So you get a lot of variety in a short amount of time. And I think I've benefited a lot as an artist in the beginning, especially as a flame artist, getting to work on a lot of variety of things, you know, and in episodics, like if you end up on a show like that has the same kind of thing because it's the same world, you're not going to be changing the things that you're doing very often. You know, maybe you get more car crashes, more bullet hits, more, you know, cleanup paint. So,
yeah, for sure. And the other thing about is if you're on a commercial that is not that great, don't worry, it's going to be over in a couple of weeks.
Exactly. No, it's true. It's over. It's over in like 2 weeks. You might be tortured for like a couple of weeks, but that's it after that.
Yeah.
I worked on a string of commercials that actually, like, from start to finish were like, they were awful, but there were like 3 to 4 day turnarounds
right
for commercials. And they had a bunch of them and the budgets were good, but it was going to be hell. And yep. I was just like, the worst that happens is like three days of hell and you're out. You just think about it that way. You're just like, after 3 days, you're out. That's it. Just close your eyes and just make it happen.
Yeah, for sure. Now it's interesting that, so, obviously the world has, when I was doing commercials, which was a while ago, but the world has changed a lot more. There's fewer commercials out there. There's a lot, people are cord cutting, so they're not really watching TV that much. But there's a ton of need of content, and episodic work is obviously a big one. Do you feel yourself sort of moving more into episodic? Do you feel you want to do other kinds of work? Obviously, you mentioned trying to do your own short films. Do you have aspirations of directing? And
I think for me, I've always had aspirations of directing, only because I came in as a filmmaker. And so I fold story and narrative into a lot of my work, sometimes, even if it probably doesn't need to be, like, there's no way, how do you fold story into cleanup?
Right.
Or Roto, right? Like, yeah.
You can. I'll tell you what, I'll give you an example. I had a buddy of mine who is a texture artist. He's a really good texture artist. And he was a texture artist. And he did all the textures for Thanos, right? And so he was like drawing the fingernails and thinking about the battles that Thanos was in and what scars he would have.
Okay. That guy's the boss. You know what I mean?
It's like, what kind of a battle? Like, this was a knife fight. Like, there was every strip. You see that? But that, when you were talking about narrative and visual effects, I was thinking about Chris as like, he does that kind of stuff. Yeah.
That's awesome. Because it makes it fun also. It makes it fun, and it makes it like, you can come up with these narratives and you tell you tell somebody that you created a texture on Thanos's finger from a war that he had, people will be like, yo, this dude is doing all my textures.
Yeah.
That's the guy doing all my textures. You kidding me, man? He's putting meaning into texturing fingers of stories of war.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Yeah. But I think you're right. But that's the kind of mentality that you have. Right? You thought about the story of the smoke, right?
Everybody thought I was crazy. And it was also like I just started like a week ago. They're like, who the hell is this guy trying to get story into smoke? There's a fire, put some smoke. What do you want? But yeah, for sure. I think that I definitely have aspirations of directing. I want to direct, one of the things that I think I always get perplexed with a little bit is the fact that as a visual effects artist, there are so many ways we can tell stories and so many ways we can use our skill sets and tools. We can create entire universes. We can create entire cities. You can do all these crazy, awesome dreamscape things, creatures, effects. And more often than not, like, we end up having to relegate our skills and our talents to like a small number of types of work, like big Marvel film visual effects, crashes, aliens. And I feel like it's a little bit of a disservice to visual effects artists because you're not allowed all the time to flex yourself as creatively. And I think it goes back a little bit to like thinking outside of the box as like a flame artist trying to solve solutions and do things with the tools that you have. I think those limitations actually help foster more creativity. And I would love to be able to tell more stories where visual effects are used in much more unexpected ways, not just to do like a Marvel superhero film. I've seen a couple of visual effects films over the years that have just been like made me pretty excited. Like an Arrival was one of them. Interstellar was another very interesting one. Those films, and as far as the Marvel universe goes, I think one of the ones that I really loved was the magician one. What was that called?
Doctor Strange.
Doctor Strange. Yeah, I loved watching that film, especially in the beginning. I think Framestore did a lot of the work where the city was folding on top of each other. Obviously, right. I think there was some inspiration from like Inception and stuff, but
right.
those films were so, those there were such interesting ways of using visual effects rather than just explosions and superpowers and lasers and spaceships. Right. You know, it's just, you can literally create anything, you know, like anything that you could imagine as an artist, you can do. Right. So like, why do we limit ourselves to a certain amount of work? I understand that you need the right budget and it has to be viable, but I just wish that, you know, we could be allowed to flex our muscles story-wise and creatively as artists in different ways, you know. And that's my hope for myself as a visual effects supervisor, as a visual effects artist, is that one day to be able to use visual effects to tell like more interesting, unique stories. Sure, they might not make $200 million, but at least it would be like something very different than what we've seen visual effects be used for, you know?
Right.
And that's my hope, because I truly do think as if you lock yourself into doing things like that over and over again, you're not allowing your creativity and your muscles to flex as an artist, you know? You should be doing like, it's like working your, as a weightlifter, working your biceps or whatever and your triceps, you know, you want to try to flex your muscles as a creative by trying unique, different exercises, random things. I really love the Instagram culture where they have like, I think motion graphics artists, actually, most of them end up being like cinema 4D artists that do all these like really interesting CG kind of like loops.
Explorations.
Yeah. And they're so fun. They look so cool. You're like, okay, maybe you can't, it doesn't tell a story, but it's so interesting knowing that you could create something like that or experiment and just put, it almost feels like visual effects art in a way, you know, mm-hmm. like, and I love that. I love going on Instagram and I follow a lot of artists that do a lot of those kinds of things. And I'm like, yeah, you forget that actually you can do so many crazy, different, fun things with CGI, you know, outside of just creating dragons and flames and explosions and things like that.
Yeah. And you know, those are the days when, you know, when it was inventive, you know, and it was interesting.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, even in the early days of visual effects, it was inventive. And sometimes you look back and like, who would come up with that? You know, like The Abyss, you know.
Yeah, The Abyss. Oh my God. Yeah.
You know,
but I would argue that like The Abyss, you look back on the story, is that like it was due to limitations, you know.
Right.
There were limitations in computer graphics and computer processing, and they had to create a monster. And so they decided to do this goopy reflective thing because those are the limitations that they had. And actually having less limitations stopped people from being more creative. Because
right.
you just sought after photoreal work, right? You're just trying to reproduce photoreality. And then with the Marvel films, now everybody just wants super photoreal, like superhero films. That's it,
right.
that people are going after. And I mean, I got to tell you, like the resources and the amount of artists and the feat of creating some of those worlds and universes is astounding. You know,
right.
I think like the last Avengers film was like 1,300 visual effects artists or something around the world, you know, and you're just like,
but at the same time, you can create a film like Ex Machina, right? Which uses a whole lot less and still wins an Oscar.
Wins an Oscar. Yeah.
It's so true. So it's, but you know what? They were trying to tell a story. They weren't trying to dazzle you with spectacle. And Marvel right now tries to dazzle you with spectacle, and it's not necessarily about the story. Listen, I don't want to take up too much more of your time because we're over an hour, but I know did you mention that you do a podcast as well? You've got a couple of other channels.
Yeah.
I want to make sure you get your plugs in and tell me all the cool stuff you're up to.
Yeah, for sure. So I have a podcast right now called Legends of VFX.
Nice.
And the idea behind it is, like I was saying, I want to connect other artists to every kind of part of the creative process with visual effects artists. So I've interviewed recruiters, I've interviewed other visual effects artists, I've interviewed directors that I've worked with, I've interviewed clients that I've worked with, because I think it's really important for people to have conversations with clients. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think it's really cool having, we're going to have clients on there talking about their relationships with me and working together with me. And I just think it's really important because the idea of it is I just want people to understand that, like we were saying, visual effects artists are artists in themselves. And talking to the collaborators that they work with, I'm hoping that the podcast brings a little bit of insight into the kind of work we do, kind of collaborations, and hopefully broadens people's understanding of visual effects and visual effects work in the world. You know, one of the things I said was that kind of like sparked me creating this podcast and doing this was just the fact that I had watched the Oscars and Cats had happened and James Corden came on and made fun of the visual effects artists that worked on Cats because he was like, Cats is what happens when visual effects, bad visual effects happens in a film. And
no, that was not their choice.
Yeah, go ahead. You can say
it's not their choice.
Yeah,
I mean, these are decisions made by someone else and the visual effects people. I mean, listen, I worked on Stealth, you know, so I'm just going to tell you know, there was some lot of like, you know, hold on, what?
Yeah.
What am I doing? Okay, I'll do that. But that wasn't my choice. That's in the script.
Yeah, exactly. And that was what I was trying to dispel, really, like that visual effects artist, it's a visual effects artist's fault that a bad story idea happens or a bad character design happens. That's not always like visual effects artists. And so my idea was to create a film to dispel some of that and broaden people's understanding of what visual effects artists do, how valuable visual effects artists can be and how creative they can be in the filmmaking and storytelling process. So that podcast is going. We've got 6 episodes. I've got a 7th episode coming out soon. It takes a little bit of time to make them because I'm asking specific questions and we're trying to curate it with music and things like that. Yeah, but the episodes are good. You listen to them. I hope people listen to each episode and learn something new, get some kind of new insight into the kind of work we do. Outside of that, I'm working on a film, a short film it's just a documentary. It's not a film about with any kind of visual effects or anything. It's a short documentary called Born Ben, which should be coming out later this year. It's about cerebral palsy, my friend Ben who has cerebral palsy, and his hope is to be the first basketball coach with cerebral palsy in college. Yeah. And so that's a really cool film. It's great. We're doing some 2D animation in it and we're hoping to release that by like the beginning of next year. So,
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
For sure. I think it's always nice to kind of like break up doing really visual effects stuff. And then for me anyways, do things that are outside of what I always do. And that's part of the reason I was doing podcasts. Yeah. It's like creatively giving yourself a little bit of a break.
Yeah. I think, but you also need to flex your other creative muscles so that you're not just stuck in one thing, you know? So
yeah.
That's a great thing. Yeah.
Totally.
This has been amazing. Such a great conversation with you. It's so funny like to hear all these stories. It's been a long time since I've done commercial work, but I was like, oh man,
yeah.
You and I would have done some great work together. I know that. So
yeah, it would have been a lot of fun.
Like
we had a good time.
Yeah. It's great. So thank you so much for sharing that and sharing your ideas and you know, letting us know about your podcast. I'm sure people will do it. Where can they find it? Anywhere they can get your podcast?
Yeah, you can find it. It's on Apple, Spotify, anywhere you can find podcasts. It's called Legends of VFX. And yeah, that's it. Maybe I can send you a link or something. So absolutely.
We'll put it in our show notes. We'll put that in the show notes. And then you think your documentary is coming out later this year. So once that's out, let us know and we can add that to the show notes later in case people
get it. Okay, awesome. Yeah.
That'd be great.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it, Chris.
Yeah, that's great. All right. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, it was great talking to you. Keep in touch. Maybe I'll talk to you again soon.